Given how Uber and Lyft have changed mobility, it's incredible that less than 15 years ago, they didn't even exist. Gone are the days of waiting on a street corner in the rain to hail a cab or digging for cash to make taxi fare. Technology has enabled the creation of mobile platforms that make getting from point A to B a press of a button on your phone. So, what can the consumer expect next that will make mobility even more efficient, sustainable, and valuable? My guest on today's episode, Alain Visser, is founder and CEO of Lincoln Co., a mobility company with a unique subscription-based membership model that focuses on connectivity, sharing, and sustainability. We talk about the inspiration behind Lincoln Co., their vehicle design, ownership options, technology, and even how Lincoln Co. members can actually make money sharing their car. It's a great conversation you won't want to miss. Join me, Ed Bernardin, on this episode of The Future Car for a look at a unique approach to personal mobility. Alain, welcome to The Future Car Podcast.
Thank you very much, Ed. Great to be there.
Like you say, you don't consider yourself to be a car maker, but rather a mobility brand. You even go so far to say, as I've read, you're the rude rebel of the automotive industries, and cars should be like celebrities, easy to cancel. That's a great slogan. Tell us what all this means.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's difficult to summarize it in one sentence, but I would say I spent 36 years in the car industry in different major companies and realized that nothing is really changing and that we just keep on doing the same thing, which is basically making cars, shipping them to our dealers who sell and repair them. And the world is changing and we see people's needs are evolving rapidly. And there's a growing percentage of people who, as you said, yes, they want to use a car, they want to drive. But more and more people are thinking, do I really need to own a car? Is that the only way solution to then be mobile with a car? And the most shocking statistic that I've seen in the last 10 years, Ed, is that the average car on this planet stands still for 96% of the time. That's just shocking. So it's a very inefficient asset that we buy. We spend so much money for using it for 4% of the time. So I thought when I started this company about 6-7 years ago, let's do something else than just selling cars. Let's offer an experience to our customers that includes mobility. And that's really where we started from.
What was the driving force that made you think about providing mobility in a different way?
I think it's two things. It's going to sound religious, but it's actually a true story. My two sons, who are true millennials, they're 23, 27, both live in London. They asked me about, that same period 7 years ago. So, Dad, what have you been doing your whole life? And I came to the very sobering answer that I sold cars, and that didn't really give me a warm feeling, thinking there must be something more positive to do other than just selling cars. And the second thing, Ed, is that I get a little bit upset when all the car manufacturers are now suddenly saying we're sustainable. Whereas, as I said, if your business model consists on selling as many as possible cars that are standing still for 96% of the time, you can be as electric as you want to be. It's not a sustainable business model. So I thought, let's do something that is more in touch with the consumer needs of today, which is not necessarily owning a car for a growing percentage, and something that at the same time is more sustainable, which means that not only the product is more sustainable, but the usage of the product is more sustainable than just letting it hanging around for 96% of the time.
Traditionally, we think of ourselves as owning a car. What you're describing is you want to own mobility. Because you're not, when your car is sitting there for 96% of the time, nothing is mobile. In fact, it's sitting there. That's the opposite of being mobile.
That's exactly right. And that goes hand in hand with another, I think, extremely interesting phenomena based on the research that we have done 7 years ago, and of course we continue to update it, is that one of the most interesting trends that we see both in the US, in Europe, and in China is that people more and more spend more time on doing things rather than on buying things. So the ownership becomes less important. The experience becomes much more important. And you can just see it everywhere. Yoga, sports, trips, instead of just buying stuff. And of course, the more you're interested in the stuff, in the things you do, then rather than the things you own, you also start being more open to share the things you own because you don't care that much about it anymore. So we see a sharing community starting, but also a community, an organization, a society where people want to have experience. So we said, yeah, we have a cool car. Let's just not sell it. Let's use the car to offer an experience that is shareable rather than just sell the thing.
Your company's values, I love how you explain it. Open, simple, sustainable, and wow. W-O-W, wow. So how can you be wow and simple at the same time? I think this comes into this whole idea of experience versus ownership.
I would say the simplicity is for me the transparency, brutally simple, no small letters from that and that and that and that is not included. But also to give a simple example about our simplicity, we have one car in two colors with no options. So our configurator on our website is black or blue. That's it. In all other car manufacturers, you'd have different models. We have one. You have different trim levels. We have one. You'd have then 16-inch wheels, 17-inch wheels, 15 colors. We just have black and blue, and all the rest is standard. So that's what we mean with simple, brutally simple.
Well, you know, Henry Ford, when he started the assembly line, said you can have any color you want as long as it's black. But you added a second color. Why not just black? Why black and blue?
Actually, we were thinking of reusing that slogan. It's available in all colors as long as it's black, dot, 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 or blue. So I'm still thinking of that. I still like the idea. But indeed, sometimes simplicity can be wow. Because like, oh, cool. I really don't have the complexity of having to choose. We say our experience needs to be wow. And for me, the definition of wow is if something is wow, you go home and you talk about it to your parents, your children, your friends. You don't just react when they ask. We want people, when they have visited, for example, Lincoln Co. Club, we want them to come to their friends and say, you know what? Today I was at Lincoln Co. Club. You really have to go there. It is something different. That's what I believe is wow. The link between the simple, brutally simple, but wow in a way that it totally differentiates from anything else you've seen.
Let's talk a little bit now about where your disruption really comes from. And that's all the different ways in which you can acquire mobility from Lincoln Company. I was very careful in the words I use there because we're not really just buying a car from you, although that is one of the options. So tell us about subscription, traditional leasing, purchasing, car sharing, rental. Maybe you could go through and explain to everyone really what all this disruption is about in terms of how you can actually own mobility.
Exactly. So Lincoln Co., and by the way, it's not Lincoln Company, it's Lincoln Co.
Lincoln
very
Co.,
sensitive
all right.
to that. It's Lincoln Co., exactly. So basically, I would say our mother offer, our DNA is a subscription model, which basically means you buy a month with a car, and it's really just 1 month. You can cancel after 1 month. You only commit to 1 month. You buy, for the moment, it's in Europe, 550 euros. Everything is included, service, warranty, insurance. So everything is included at a certain mileage, which in our case is 15,000 kilometers per year. So it really covers everything. And that's the 1 month contract, which, to make it clear for the B2C, the retail private customers, is about 99% of the customers. But we've always said, we don't want to push an ownership to our customers. The customers decide. If somebody comes into our club and says, I really love this car, I want to buy it, it would be quite arrogant, if not stupid, to say, no, you can't. So we said, yeah, you can buy it as well. It is there. It exists. We offer the monthly subscription. You can buy it, but you can also lease it. So there's a leasing availability when you say, instead of only committing to 1 month, I just want to commit it for 24 months, 36 months or more. And that, of course, as you can imagine, Ed, is particularly our fleet customers, our B2B customers are particularly interested in. But then I think what makes us stand out probably is that, look, there are a lot of leasing companies, there's a lot of rental companies because the subscription is closer to a rental than to a lease. But what we then also do is that during the time you have the vehicle, in any of the cases, leasing, subscription, or buying, you can share the car. And the more you share the car, the more your cost goes down because, of course, you get the revenue from the period that another person is using your car. So that's a bit the whole concept. Subscription, leasing, buying, and in for all of three of them, you can share it.
So I can come in. Do you call it a dealership or a club?
No, we call it a club.
All right. So I come to the club and I can buy or lease, like many people have done for many, many years, or I can get the subscription. I like this idea. In the subscription, if I purchase the black one and in 3 months I want the blue one, can I switch? Or in the future, if you have more models?
Yeah, you can. And basically, that's also for us an easy thing is you only have two choices. There's not a lot of swapping going on.
Is there plans in the future to have more models if you wanted to switch from a, let's say your family grows, for instance, and you want a larger car or you like a sporty one or something like that? Is that the idea that you'd be able to move between the different models easily?
I would say not so really. We want to keep it back to our simple as part of our DNA. We want to keep it brutally simple. I can well imagine us having two and in the worst case or most extreme case, three vehicles, but definitely not more than that. We're more the kind of brand that says, okay, with one car, now our 01 is a 4.5 meters car. I don't know what that is in inches, but it's sort of like a compact SUV. It's small enough for the city and it's big enough for a small family. With that, we cover about 70% of the customers. And that's a little bit what we want to achieve. We now have a plug-in hybrid car, which we've chosen because of the infrastructure, the charging infrastructure in Europe. But our plan is to move into a full electric, and that will already happen next year. Because we believe also at Lynk & Co that the future of the car is a full electric vehicle.
So then you bring in this car sharing, which I think is really interesting. So I drive the car to work, and now it's just sitting in the parking lot. So the idea is, I could have that car available for car sharing. How does that work?
So I'll try to explain it. We always say it should be, to share our car should be as simple as to share a pizza. And there we go again with the simplicity. So I'll explain it to you. So the only thing you have to do is the app. You need to have the Lynk & Co app. For to become a member and to share, the membership is free. What you then do is when I open my app, I would see all the Lynk & Co's automatically that are in my area that are available for sharing. So if I want to share my car, I make my car just shareable from to at the price that I decide. If you then open your app, you would see my car amongst many others. If you decide you want my car, you click on that car. You then get my contacts and you get a code. With that code, with your phone, you can open my car and you can drive my car for that period. So it's as simple as that. No keys to be exchanged, etc. Insurance is covered within the policy and you collect the car where it is and you bring it back where you collected it, unless you and I agree that it's going to be a day later or another location. But the standard procedure is you just pick it up where I left it and you bring it back at the time that we agreed. And the payment all happens online via credit card transfer. So it's all integrated in the app that we designed and worked on together. Yeah.
And you can decide the price.
Yeah.
You're competing in a way against the other Lynk & Co owners. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We had long discussions of how we do it. And we basically said, let's learn from the experts like Airbnb. And Airbnb, you decide a price as well. what we do is we give an indicative price because of the problem in Europe is, I guess, is the same in US. Rental prices in Munich are not the same as in London or in Paris. So we, based on the city where you are, we give sort of the average price what people use to charge for the borrowing. And then they decide. And you see on your app the cars that are available and what their prices is. So you either take the cheapest, I guess, or maybe the one that is closest to you. That's your choice. But you, if you are the guy who has a subscription, it's your decision. It's not us.
So in effect, you become like a Zipcar or basically a rental car company in a way.
Yeah, it is. And that's, I like it how you put it in the beginning, because people always ask me, so what's so unique about Lynk & Co? And I would say, nothing that we do doesn't exist, but the combination of the ingredients doesn't exist, because we do all the things. There are rental companies. Our subscription is closer to rental. There are sharing companies, but you don't have a sharing company or a rental company where you can share your car. And then on top of that, the brutal simplicity of the choice. And of course, the fact that we offer experiences in our clubs. And I would love to show the images of the club, because I think seeing it is believing it. And I'd love to invite you, Ed, to one of the openings of our clubs, because they're a little bit out of this world.
Are you actually in one of your clubs right now?
No, I'm actually in our office. And I would say, even if you'd be in our office, you would say, what the hell is this? It's become a tourist attraction, our office. And I would almost say it's very much like a club. So it's very, very different.
Well, maybe you could take us on a little tour later towards the end of the interview here. Maybe you can grab your laptop and
yeah,
move
not?
Your camera around. When you do this car sharing and you're bringing money in, do you get to keep all the money? Does Lynk & Co. take a cut from that, or is it all yours?
We take indeed the cut. So the fact is that we have strategically decided not to make money on sharing. We just recover the costs. We see sharing as one, our strategic goal from a sustainability point of view, to have cars being utilized more. But we see more and more people are starting to share their car now as a reason why people join Lynk & Co. So if you, for example, say you make your car available for, I'm just saying something, $30 per day, the ones that open the app will probably see something like $33, and the $3 then covers the costs in terms of the whole operation, insurance, etc. And I think the relevance of the numbers 30 versus 33 is about right. So it's just a couple of dollars that get added to cover for the administration cost and insurance. Yeah.
Has anyone approached you and said, oh, I'd like to buy 100 cars from you, or a large number, and basically become a rental? I don't know if you call it a rental car or a car sharing company.
We have been selling a lot of cars in big numbers, including to car rentals, to rental car companies. But interesting, they are using them without any exception, like any other car within a rental car company. It's for us, I must say, we like that. We like the fact that, because let's face it, as our strategic objective is to utilize cars more, the rental car companies are the experts. They lose money if cars are standing still. So they fit into our strategic target. I would almost say they're an extension to what we try to do. But as far as I know, they do not offer the sharing during the period that a car is rented, probably for logistical reasons.
So if you're making money sharing it, let's say I bought or leased it from you, so I have lease payments, but I can share my car. Is it possible to actually get a car and make a profit or break even? How does it all add up in the end?
Totally. We actually have now about 20 customers now in different countries that actually make more money from sharing than they pay in their monthly subscription. To give you an idea, in Europe now, you pay 550 euros. We have quite some customers who now make more than 1,000 euros per month on sharing. So it becomes a profitable transaction to use a subscription. And we have no problem with that, because at the end of the day, it's our strategic goal. The car is utilized more. And it's good news for the customer that he actually makes money for driving our vehicle.
And good news for the city where they're driving, because fewer parking lots are needed because the cars are constantly on the road and being used.
Exactly. And look, there's different ways of sharing. This is one of them. You just share to any person available. What we now see happening, and I particularly like that part, Ed, is that what we see happening now is, say, for example, in a city like Berlin, where you have three friends and they all three need a car, but they don't really need a car every day. It's like most people, actually, you don't need a car every time. So the three friends decide to take one subscription. They split the 550 euros amongst the three of them, and they only use the app to share amongst the three of them. And they, of course, share at zero cost. And instead of having bought three cars standing still for most of the car time, they have one car that is utilized most of the time.
Is this a unique combination? Is anyone else, any other company, combining all these things into one?
We launched the idea about 4 or 5 years ago. We launched about 2 years ago. I was anticipating that there would be some following. And interestingly enough, I always say we have four ingredients: subscription, the sharing, the clubs, and the brutal simplicity of the product. And then you can add, of course, the lease, etc. There is not one company that offers even only three of the four combinations. So I'm quite surprised. The car industry continues to do the normal stuff. And the sharing companies do sharing, the rental companies do rental, and the leasing companies do leasing. But there's nobody who combines it. And I would say, well, good for us. We own a unique space already for more than 2 years now.
Why do you think that is? Is it? It's just that they're so ingrained in doing things the way they've always done it that they don't see it. But once you see it, oh, wow, this is so obvious. Why can't we do that?
I think you're right. It is because, look, I think there's the key reason is, let's face it, the car industry is very profitable. All OEMs are still making a lot of money. And then you could say, I always like it when I hear some of the OEMs saying, sharing is not working. We've tried it. And some of them buy sharing companies and then they abandon them because it's not working. But of course, look, if your key KPI of an OEM is to sell as many cars as possible, the more you share, the less cars you're going to sell. So it's a conflicting interest. So the OEMs are proving to themselves that people don't want to share. Whereas for us, we want to prove that sharing is working and it's growing really rapidly. So I think, the main reason is that most of these companies are profitable in doing what they do, and they say, why change a winning horse? So they continue to do it. I think it's quite sad because I think there's a lot of better and cooler things to do than what happens today in the car industry.
It's interesting what you say is, in some ways, it's how a company looks at itself. Oh, we are a quote unquote car company, but you look at yourself as a mobility company. Ultimately, a company needs to make a profit. They need to be profitable. It shouldn't make a difference. And there's so many different things coming together here. You got rental car companies or ride sharing companies or traditional car companies. It would seem that any of those could expand to start doing what you're doing. It's almost that ownership of mobility starts to become a gray area. Do you think that's what's going to happen in the years to come, that all of this will evolve?
I do indeed agree that that is what's going to happen. Look, and I'm not saying they are wrong and we are right. We still see the majority of people on this planet buying or leasing a car. But we see that smaller percentage of people growing very fastly, of people who just want something fundamentally different. And for them, there is no brand. So we want to be that brand. And according to our statistics, Ed, about 15% of the global car buyer, US, Europe, not that different, are open for something fundamentally different. And then you could ask yourself, so why the hell do you focus on the 15 and not on the 85? But I always say, the 85, there's about 150 car brands that are there for them. For the 15, there's nobody. And 15 is a lot of customers. So the business potential is very high. But to your question, my personal point of view, and this is personal, I think less and less people are going to buy a car. I think electrification, as we see it happening now, is just going to happen. Is it a big deal? I don't think so. It's just another machine under the hood. The big change will be with autonomous drive. And that doesn't mean that suddenly people can read a newspaper while they're driving. It basically means people will not buy cars any longer. You will just use an app, as we have already today. And when you need a car, you just call it. It's like an Uber without a driver. And that means you don't have to park your car. You don't have to service your car. the car industry needs to decide, do you want to be Boeing or do you want to be Lufthansa? You don't fly to New York with a Boeing, you fly to New York with Lufthansa. It's the service brand that counts. Already today, you don't go to the city center with a Toyota Prius, you go to the city center with an Uber. So the service brand becomes more important than the product brand. And what I've been saying since the beginning of Lynk & Co, I want Lynk & Co to be a service brand with a product rather than a product brand with a service.
I love your example, because if you think about going into a plane, is it an Airbus or is it a Boeing? You don't really know. But what you do notice is you say, oh, the Delta business class or the Delta Comfort Plus is so much better or different than you. That's what you remember. And I suppose that's what this will end up, especially when you go autonomous. And it's not even about actually steering and driving anymore, but the experience that you have. You recently did a survey, which I think is really interesting. And you found that there were differences by country and by age in the willingness to share. So fundamental to many of the aspects that we're talking about here is sharing your car. Tell us a little bit, how is it different, older versus younger, North America, Europe, Asia? What differences do you see in willingness to share?
Yeah, good question. And indeed, we did that study for the moment only in Europe. And we came to some, I thought, fascinating conclusions that we had different purposes. The one was, how would a city look like if people really share commonly, which means there are way less cars? Because it's nice to say, oh, with less cars, the world looks better. But people have difficulties imagining how would that be better. So we visualized, and we also asked people, if there are less cars, what do you want more? Do you want more streets? Do you want more museums? Do you want more sports fields? Do you want more parks? Do you want more art? So it's very different by country. And then also we wanted to know, are people really open for sharing? We were quite surprised that on average, about 1 out of 2 persons are ready for sharing, but that doesn't mean they all do it. But they said, yeah, I consider it, which is quite good. So the step, there's quite a small step from saying I'm open for it and then to do it. We see that, for example, in Europe, in markets like Netherlands and Sweden, the availability for sharing is much higher than in Spain and in Italy. But what we see in all countries is that in the age under 45, the willingness to share is so much higher than above 45. We see young people who, as I said in the beginning, they don't care that much about the car. They care about the experience. For them, if I have a car that I can share, why not? They care less about it. We are a bit of a disruptive and we can provoke a bit. It's part of the brand. It's part of the wow effect. The car freaks is a dying species. The people who talk about horsepower, my 6-cylinder car and from 0 to 100 in X seconds and X torque. When my sons come into my new service car, they just laugh about it. They say, Dad, I don't care. The only thing they want to know is, Dad, do you have Wi-Fi? So we have a new generation of customers coming.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I had Bob Bell. He's a former technical director for Mercedes and Renault Formula One. And we were talking about where Formula One is going in the year 2030. And I said, Bob, you know, if it's electric, you're not going to hear the roar of the engines and the smell of the petrol and all that. I go, what's going to happen to the diehard fans? And he says, oh, Ed, we don't have to worry about them. Pretty soon, they're all going to be dead. So it's like you said, it's an evolving thing. And that's where the market is headed. Younger generations have grown up sharing everything in their lives through social media. And it's just merely an extension of that. But you did say something else I think that's really interesting is, so you have all this extra parking space. What do you use it for? Art or sport? Maybe tell us a little bit about that. How does what they would do with the extra parking space change based on country or age?
That was, I think, for me, fascinating how you, because, you know, in every country, I'm sure you have in the US as well, you're probably saying that state, people are more like this than another. And you have these cliches. And you have that in Europe, of course, as well. The Italians are like that. The French are like that. The Germans are like that. And then you see that research. What do the Germans want in their cities with less cars instead of parking space? What do the Italian want? And you see these quite, for us, funny but interesting differences. In the UK, for example, they want more museum. They want also in Italy, they want more sports and they want more parks. In some areas, they really want libraries, which I was quite fascinated because people don't read that books anymore.
Really? What country was that?
I think it was actually in Germany, but it's so you see quite some differences. But it the three big ones was parks, sporting, and art. In Italy, very much focused on art. In London, very much focused on things like the parks. And then I don't know if we send you those pictures. If you then look at visualizations of, we then change some key tourist spots in Paris, in Munich, in Rome, Madrid, and we changed them based on the input of these customers. When I saw the visuals, I thought, damn, it makes you dream. Like, this is not, it's not a science fiction picture. Look, we didn't do stuff that says, okay, keep on dreaming. It looks very realistic. It just looks so much better. Because let's face it, and I think I'm allowed to say that, cars don't make cities a lot nicer at all. So take them out and cities can become so much friendlier.
Once you see what you can do with that space, oh my goodness, we have more parks, we have more museums, we have more places where we can play football, then I think people will start to value this even more. But isn't this contrary to what a car company is all about? You're actually trying to sell fewer cars.
That's why, as you said in the beginning, we don't say that we are a car company because it's not our KPI. And it's sometimes I think you just have to be reasonable and respond to what the reality is. And at 50% of city traffic in Europe is people looking for parking spots. It's just absurd. So I then drive around in Brussels or in Paris, I wouldn't feel good saying, so what is my job? I'm going to sell more of them. It's just absurd. And then I think, okay, I actually feel good now with at least trying to do something that, look, we also want to make money. Let's not be kidding ourselves. I just think there's better ways to make money in the car mobility sector than just selling more cars.
If the cars aren't parked, then that means they're somewhere else, which they're moving on roads. Do you envision that certainly less parking, and you can reuse that space in a different way, but will you have to make the roads bigger because there's more cars on the road?
I don't necessarily think so, because I think then also the sharing comes in, and you have the ride hailing. Can people also share or go together to the city? So we think from an infrastructure point of view, there's not so much needed. The only thing that would happen is, of course, instead of people going to a city, parking their car, staying there the whole day, and then driving back, the car is only needed to drop them there and then is needed to pick them up again. So the cities then themselves become a lot more emptier, even more because we assume that people living in a city will no longer buy a car. So you basically have, I would almost say, empty cities or much more empty cities, and then much more continued busy traffic in and out of the cities, yeah. But whether that needs additional infrastructure, we don't necessarily think so.
Let's talk a little bit about the Lincoln Co. 01. You say it has built-in conductivity, panoramic sunroof, parking assistance, and according to your website, quote, a whole bunch of other fun stuff. I love how you simply said that, a whole bunch of other fun stuff. I got to ask you, what is this whole bunch of other fun stuff? Because it sounds like it's really about experience. You're not bragging about the horsepower.
No, exactly. And it's so funny because my colleagues, former colleagues from the car industry, and also some of your colleagues, but then the car journalists, they said, I don't get it, because they drive our car and they say, this is a damn good car. Why don't you brag about it much more? And I said, look, everybody says they have the best car. Everybody says that. And you know what? The reality is maybe that all are right. There are no bad cars anymore. And in the meanwhile, we can talk about what we're really doing, which is selling mobility. But okay, the 01 car, is a damn good car. As I said, it's a compact SUV. We deliberately decided for a plug-in hybrid, even though we're now going to electric. But in Europe, for the moment still, the charging infrastructure is a main problem. It's growing. And now with the European Commission having decided that in the future, only electric cars will be allowed as of 2035, the trend will grow very quickly. It's a compact SUV. Some of the cool stuff to your question, we were the first car to not offer leather from a sustainability point of view. So the fabric of our seats is called Econil, which is made from a recycled fishing nets. Trust me, it doesn't smell like that. It's really a premium fabric. We have some cool stuff. We have a built-in camera, which is quite fun. So in the mirror, you can take a picture in the car and out the car. So you can basically start whatever you do, karaoke in the car, film it, and then put it on Instagram or on any social media thing. We have some apps, some game apps in the car that we introduce rather than the normal weather forecast or music. Of course, we have Spotify and the Apple CarPlay and Android on the car, but we added some nice, funny features that we think characterize us as we're more the experience brand than here is some technical blah, blah.
When you set out to design the O1, did you change your design goals based on the fact that it's more of a vehicle that will be shared? You were emphasizing experience. From an engineering standpoint, when you're setting out your specifications for the vehicle, how does that change when you're aiming for a mobility product versus a car product?
The key thing is that, without wanting to go into detail, but the car industry, the traditional car industry, makes a lot of money on servicing cars. It's a sad thing to say, but I always say it's borderline ethical, but so much money is made on servicing a car. We're basically saying, wait a minute, in our price, the subscription price of €550, everything is included, including service. So if you have to go back to repair something, that reduces our cost, our profit. So the game is very different. We try to engineer and build cars that don't need repair, because the more repair they need, the more our profit goes down. So it's a win-win for the customer. It does have implications on the whole engineering and manufacturing process, particularly on the material choices.
It sounds like you want to build in reliability. Can you give an example of what you might do that?
Bumpers. If you look at bumpers, which are an elements of wear and tear, where bumpers are made and get scratches, we want to make sure that the bumpers are made of such a material that they are matte black material, or that they are less sensitive to scratches, etc. That would be an example. All these little things that we know need to be replaced quite often, that we try to make of good, stronger materials, like the oil filters, the wash wipers of a car that so often you come in just to replace them, where we try to make them a lot stronger so that people don't have to come back.
When it comes to sustainability, you mentioned the seats made out of fishnet plastic. What else are you doing to address the issues of sustainability?
I'm a bit fascinated that in the industry, the electromobility is seen as the super driver for sustainability, but it can't be everything. So it's a choice of materials. And look, would I say today we are the most sustainable manufacturer or mobility company? I don't think so, but we definitely have the aim to go in fully into that direction. Avoid some of the materials, particularly in the interior of the car, avoid carbon, all of these materials, avoid it. And then, of course, from a manufacturing point of view, to have the whole manufacturing process to be totally sustainable. I think that the car industry today is focusing very much on the electrification, but not on the production process, nor on the materials used, particularly in the interior.
Can you tell us a little bit about the manufacturing process? In what sense is it more sustainable?
Yeah, so it's all reusable energy, the whole regenerated energy, the waste, the reusability of water. We could send you some documentation about it, but if you would visit the plant where we make, where we produce the car, I would dare to say, versus the plants I have seen in my long career in the car industry, it's close to science fiction. It's very, very modern, and it's very, very at the top edge of sustainability in terms of material use, reusability of the energy, of the water that is recycled. I think it's quite spectacular.
When your engineers are working, let's say they're working on the interior and they're trying to select the material that they'd want to use on, I don't know, the seat or the dashboard, how do they know how sustainable these materials are or what materials are available?
I think the honest answer is they don't know. So I would say the engineers engineer a vehicle. The designers then, it starts with the design. And when it comes to the choice of materials, it's particularly when it comes to the interior, it's the designers that are the driving force. And it's what is nice now that the culture of Lincoln Co. being so driven by sustainability. I remember in the beginning when I worked with the designers and said, look, we don't want leather seats. We want something more sustainable. They didn't understand it. And they were a bit upset, like, because leather has always been seen as premium, which God knows why, because even in the interior in your homes, you don't buy leather sofas anymore. But in the car industry, everything goes so much slower. So leather stayed. But now our designers are the ones saying, oh, Alain, look at this. We found this material, this fabric, this whatever, for that is super sustainable and it looks cool. So it becomes like an internal motivator. We found something that looks good, that has good quality, and it's sustainable. In the beginning, I had to convince them. Now it's part of the, I would almost say, the inherent culture of the company. My commercial team is about, I would say, around 1,000 people in the organization. 80% of those people, probably slightly more, have never worked in the car industry. These are people that come to disrupt, that would never work for a car company, but like to work for us because they like that we're trying to shock a little bit. So it makes it easier to do things differently.
There's so many things I want to ask you about that. So where do they come from, this 80%?
In the beginning, it was difficult because, of course, we didn't have a brand name. People think, what is this? It sounds a bit weird. Now we're building momentum. Business is going well. It's a talked about brand more and more in Europe. So we find it very easy to attract people. And they come from the fashion industry. They come from the retail industry. To give you an example, the car industry has zero expertise on retail. Why? Because the car industry outsources retail to franchise dealers. So we don't know retail. We think we do, but we don't. So suddenly I had to do retail because we don't have dealers. We have clubs. So who is going to do the clubs? Definitely not car guys. They have no clue. So the majority of our retail people come from other industries, like Starbucks. It's not by coincidence, but there's quite some people who have Starbucks experience who have worked at on our clubs, because for them, they know this stuff. We don't know this stuff, the car guys.
Have the Starbucks former employees thought about maybe having like a coffee, nice coffee smell inside the car when you walk in to comfort you?
I would be lying if I said that is the case. But for them, of course, they love the fact, because some of these brands like Starbucks, they have a super cool retail project and process. Our clubs, as you will see, they are different. Every club is different. So they like it that every club is a new project. But they have not been involved into product into the car. No, so I'd be exaggerating. I would be lying if I told you they have introduced a coffee smell into our cars.
So in this whole idea of sustainability, culture is very, very important. So you've instilled this culture in them. I would imagine that as your engineers are working or these groups of people are working, having information at their fingertips as to what materials might be more sustainable or how to do something at one of your clubs that's more sustainable is probably very, very important then to achieve the sustainability, because that's becoming, as you said, less important how much horsepower you have, more important how sustainable your product is going to be. Do you take steps to try and make this information more accessible so that the design can go more quickly, say?
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're right. It's all part of the culture. I spend a lot of time talking to new employees to make sure they get it. This is what we try to do. And it's not that. It's becoming more and more unnecessary to do that as we get more known. And of course, our people, they join us because of us trying to change things. But it's so important that you create a culture where people know it's no longer about this in this company, it's now about that. And look, as much as I, after 7 years doing this now, I would be lying if I said it's been so easy. It's been very, very difficult.
Well, earlier in our discussion, you mentioned plans for an electric vehicle, for an EV. What's the plans? Tell us a little bit about where you're headed in this direction.
That was always the plan. In the beginning, we doubted to start with a BEV or not. As I explained before, we didn't do it because of the infrastructure. If you only have one car, then a car that has some limitations from a usability point of view is probably not the wise choice. But we now to plan to introduce end of next year a fully electric car that will be more or less the same, similar dimensions to the car today. As you know, we don't talk so much about new products in advance, but it will be, the concept will stay the same. The car will look super cool. We want to add some elements that, as you said, are the cool, fun stuff, but it will be a full electric, a little bit like compact size vehicle. Yeah.
So your current vehicle, plug-in hybrid, hybrid electric, now you're moving to a full electric. When you design and engineer a full electric car, what are some of the challenges that come up that are new compared to what you've done in the past?
Well, it's a very different packaging, the engine, or let's say the batteries underneath the car. So it's a very different setup. And of course, a lot of the first electric cars were built on a non-electric architecture. Now the new electric cars are built on platforms that are made for electric cars, which make it so much easier. So our car, of course, will be based on a pure electric platform, which makes it so much more efficient. But of course, the needs of those customers are very different. And the issue still remains. When you look what were the barriers for electric car 10 years ago, some of them have disappeared, but it's still the same. It's cost, it's range, and it's the charging infrastructure. You could say the cost has improved a lot, the range has improved a lot, but the infrastructure is still the main problem. And you see that the degree of full electric cars is different by country. It's, by the way, still pretty low in the US, as you know yourself. Here in Europe, it goes from an 80% in Norway to about 4% in Italy. So there's massive variances even in our old European continent.
There's a lot of things here that really come together that are coupled. You can put more batteries in the car to get it more range, but now you're putting more weight in it. And of course, there's the sustainability associated with the materials and the minerals and everything that are in the batteries. But then you have infrastructure. If you had more infrastructure, maybe you wouldn't need as much range. How do you see all that coming together?
I think different people have different views, and I read them with interest, and I'm not saying I got it right. I just have my opinion. I just think the whole range discussion we're having today is a temporary necessity. And it's only driven by the fact that the charging infrastructure and the charging speeds are insufficient. I would dare to say that in 5 years, nobody's going to talk about range. Like today, who cares about the range of a petrol car? Nobody cares, because if it's empty, you just fill it. And that's going to be the same in the future with battery electric cars. If it's empty, you just charge it. And it's only a matter of time that charging a battery will take a similar time as filling up a petrol car. And a lot of people will say, no, Alain, it's not going to happen. Those are the same people that 20 years ago said there will never be an electric car that drives more than 100 miles on one battery. And we always end up proving that we were wrong and things happen. So for me, the range discussion is just a temporary discussion that will fade away in a matter of few years, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're probably right. If in a traditional ownership, if you think about how many miles you might drive in a day, it's probably not that much. And so you could probably get away with less than 100-mile range. The interesting thing, though, is in your model, that car is going to be on the road almost all the time, or ideally all the time. So for you, the fast charge has to be very, very critical. Have you thought much about that?
I think the honest answer is we really focus on the technology of the car. We don't focus so much on the infrastructure and the technology of the charging, which I think should be another industry, another responsibility. The car manufacturers don't own the Essar, BP, petrol stations, another industry. I'm just surprised that that industry is not so much awake as I thought it would be, nor are the politicians to drive that infrastructure. So yeah, it's our cars are going to be fully electric. And I think the number one enabler to make electrification happen faster is going to be infrastructure.
I'm in Boston, and that corridor between Boston and Washington, D.C., you have New York City, you have Philadelphia. There's a lot of dense population. Using Tesla as an example, they have superchargers everywhere. We did a trip actually in a Model 3 from Baltimore all the way to Boston, and it wasn't a problem. But try and drive from, I don't know, I'm just throwing something out there, Cheyenne, Wyoming to Omaha, Nebraska, or somewhere in the center of the country, and it's going to be a little bit more difficult to take those longer kind of trips. Speaking of that, you're in Europe now. I believe you have plans potentially to come to the United States with this electric version of the vehicle.
I would say more ambitious than plans. It's always been my dream, and I'm totally convinced that not everywhere, but in some of the selective places in the US, I think our business model would fly with the right car.
As you go, try and go to a new country, regulations vary so much. How does the regulations for instance, regulations for how you rent or lease or whatever it might be, how does the government in different countries and regulations impact your global plans for expansion?
Oh, very much. Even in Europe, every country has a different legislation, taxation, etc. Of course, we have the same import taxes. This is why one of the few advantages of having a European Union. For the rest, all countries behave a bit like different entities, but it does impact a lot, and it can slow down or complicate things very, very much. And the US, of course, is a super complicated market. The number one issue, of course, being the franchise law, which is unique in the US, and where even the local players like Tesla had to deal with quite a lot of problems. The dealer organizations are very protected. That's an example of how do you deal with that if you go into a market where we from the beginning have said we're not going to have dealerships. We work with dealerships who service our cars, which in Europe is the Volvo network, and we love to work with them because it also gives reliability to our brand as the brand is linked to the Volvo technology. We would very much like to do that in the US as well. But the legislation in the US, the rules, the taxation, franchise law, it's a minefield. It's like years of pure paperwork before you can even start the real stuff.
Do you feel that it's these types of regulations that might be slowing your movement to the US?
I wouldn't say so. I don't think they would slow us down more than any other car brand. I'm allowed to say that. I don't think that the US has a system that makes it for new players more difficult. I don't think so. It's just that we need to take it into account. Coming to the US with any new brand is a complex matter. And a lot of it is, of course, because of the safety regulations, homologation standards. And that's good that those exist. So it's difficult. But let's see how it evolves. How it evolves, because it's, of course, you have a very protective car industry that also and a lot of the things we do are maybe not necessarily car industry driven. That could be a complication depending on how the different regulations change. And then the other thing in the US is that what is true in California is not true in whatever. So it's quite a minefield. Yeah.
It's this kind of discussion that gets people to understand a little bit what you're facing. And certainly with autonomous cars, maybe to a lesser extent with electric cars, the people that make the laws, the legislatures, the politicians, the government, sometimes aren't the most educated on the technical issues. And now you're layering something else on top of that, which is, oh, here's a completely new way of buying and selling and renting and owning. Do you have any ideas on how you could educate the government or the regulators so that this could happen sooner rather than later?
I would be lying if I said we have a concrete plan, but my experience and maybe my naive belief, Ed, is that if something is better for society and for the consumer, there's no way of stopping it. That's my learning. I love the Uber case. You could write a book about it. I would, by the way, impressed how Uber is much more established in the US than it is in Europe. In Europe and still some countries, it's illegal because it fights and the taxi industry is fighting against it. In US, it's embraced. And I was quite impressed when I was with you at CES in Las Vegas that the hotels have a taxi stand, an Uber stand. So it's really integrated. And I have the naive belief that in good organizations like the US, if something is better for the consumer, it will happen.
I think you're right, because I used to remember when I would travel, I don't know, let's go back to the pre-Uber days, you always had to have cash because you had to pay the taxi driver cash. Now, all taxis take credit cards, pretty much. And that's because of Uber. So it just takes time. I think, like you say, over time, especially if there's pressure from the consumer and that's what they want. You've worked for GM, Opel, Volvo. What did you learn there that helped you be successful now?
Without wanting to sound negative, I have enjoyed every part of my career. I worked for GM, for Ford, for Volvo. I've enjoyed it. Great companies. But still, I would say that what I'm doing today, Ed, is a revolution against my own past, because I'm just a little bit disappointed, more than a little bit disappointed, that massive industry that is so sexy from the outside, that claims to be so innovative, for me is not innovative at all. The business model has been the same for decades. The product has evolved, but then I would say that this product, the smartphone, has evolved more in the last 5 years than a car in the last 50 years. So I think there's such a massive exaggeration. So sometimes I think, how the hell did I survive so long in companies that don't change, that don't evolve? On the other hand, I would say, I don't think I could have been able to do what I do today without the experience that I built up in the past. And also, if you try to disrupt an industry, you get more credibility if you come from that industry, because it's not somebody who doesn't have a clue and it comes with theories that are not founded. I do have a clue. After 36 years, I know this industry. So I think it's given me also the strength, but most of all, the credibility to move further.
Tesla and Elon Musk change how you buy cars. I know of some friends that they just went online, they picked their colors, boom, boom, boom. Then they go pick up. You've actually taken this a step further, much further than what Tesla's at. Have you ever spoken to Elon Musk about this kind of disruption?
No, I'd love to, actually. No, I've never met him. I've never met him. I'd love to meet him, but I'm not at all at his level, Ed, from any point of view. But I would love it. But indeed, without wanting to sound arrogant, I think what they have done is a revolution more product-driven. What we try to do is a revolution more usage of the product. So it's a very different business model. I don't think the business model has changed that much in Tesla, but the product is a revolution, I think, what he's done.
If you think about that experience, you go online, you pick the color. Next thing you know, you pick up your car. How so much different than going online and figuring out what the lowest price is that you can negotiate with the dealership and fighting for. Many people just hated doing that. Now it's simpler.
It is. And look, we don't offer discount. It's a fixed price. And I look, the car industry is full of anachronisms that nobody questions. You just take it for granted, both from the business as from the product. Why don't you discount a $10 T-shirt from H&M, but you do discount $100,000 Mercedes. Why? Because we've taken it for granted. And look, let's face it, as a customer, you do that discussion once every, say, 4 years, but a salesman does it twice a day. So guess who's better at it? But we take it for granted and we said, take it away, no discount. The other thing, from a product point of view, I always love the example. We are so arrogant about the innovation of our product. I was at a presentation some months ago, and I wanted to shock a bit and make people a bit annoyed in this industry, and I seem to have managed. But I showed a picture of a 4T and a modern car, once I say the name. The 4T had one wash wiper on the front windscreen that hanged on the top of the windscreen to keep the raindrops away from the window. Today, 120 years later, a car has two wash wipers from the bottom. No engineer can explain me that in 2023, the best way to keep rain from your window is two sticks with a rubber thing around it. And yet it's the same after 120 years. And that's a small detail. I can name you 20, 30 of that on every car today, modern car. This wow innovation, this wow industry, yes, a lot has happened, but I am sorry, not enough has happened.
You're part of the Geely Group, and they own Volvo, Polestar, Proton, Lotus, London EV Company, Smart. Do you work across the divisions here? Do you get any ideas from the other groups?
Not so much. We have communication, but we work pretty independent. A lot of the technology in terms of the car architectures are shared, but when it comes to the business, they run very differently. Within that group, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say we're a bit the wild horse in the stable, a bit of an experiment. The others are strong players, but play their role within, if I could say so, the more car technology-driven technology. Our part is much more to disrupt, test a new way of how this industry could look like in X years. And it's very much, from a business point of view, quite independent.
You spoke earlier, and I wanted to leave this for last, the club, the wow factor. And that is, it sounds like it's a very interesting, crazy place. Tell us about the club. Tell us about the architecture of it. I've seen photos of crazy colored couches and all sorts of murals and things on the walls.
I have to be careful with my vocabulary, but I'm going to say it anyway. In the briefing of the clubs, the responsible, the Starbucks guy, asked me, if somebody enters the club, what should be the first thing they say? And I'll never forget, my answer was, what the fuck? So sorry for that on this. And look, the background of it is this, Ed. I'm a strong believer that you can create a business online, but you can't create a brand online. You need to have human interface. So our clubs are not our selling distribution chain. They're part of the marketing organization. By the way, they are. The clubs are not in the sales organization. They're in the marketing organization. They are, for me, the like 3D billboards, and they say who we are. We sell sustainable stuff there. If you come into a club, 95% of people enter a club have no idea what Lincoln Co. is. They come in, they say, oh, what the hell is this? They think it's a bar, then they think it's a concept store, and then they walk around a bit and say, oops, there's even a car. And then, of course, people start to explain them what it is. But they are in the city center. They're not like car dealerships outside of the city. They're in the middle of the city where the shopping and the bars and the restaurants are. They're about 400 square meters. And there's always one car. The rest is stuff that you can buy that looks cool, that has a sustainable story. All the furniture has a sustainable background. We now have 11 clubs. The one here in the town where I live is all in flashy orange, everything. The toilet paper, the toilet is in orange. We have a full pink room where everything is totally pink. But we only sell also sustainable and cool things, everything with a cool story. We sell a pen, for example, that is made from recycled illegal arms. So everything has a cool story.
Yeah, recycling fishnets, illegal arms, that's good. Get the bad stuff and make it into something good.
Exactly.
One last question here on the future. Let's take a step back. You've revolutionized. You're in the process of revolutionizing how we buy, own mobility. If we go ahead 20, 30 years from now, what innovations in the actual vehicles themselves, in the modes of transportation, and how we experience it? Tell us your vision.
I think people will start buying less and less cars and use more and more cars. But the real game changer is going to be autonomous drive, which is not because people, as I said before, are then suddenly going to drive without hands, but it means that people will just use cars. And I think there's going to be times where our grandchildren will say, can you imagine for about 100 years, we let people drive these things? And there was about a million and more people who died in car accidents and nothing really happened. So I think autonomous drive is going to be the big change where people, instead of buying a car, leasing a car, renting a car, will have an app. And that app provides them the mobility service. And whenever they need a car, they get one. And it's, as I said, an Uber without a driver. And I believe that is going to be the big change. More and more people live in and around the cities. The volume car manufacturers, if I can say so, are going to be suppliers to these service companies that offer those apps. And then I think there's going to be the premium brands, the Ferraris, the Porsche, the Lamborghinis. I like to call them toys for boys. I always compare with the expensive luxury watch industry, which has never bloomed as much as in the last decade, whereas nobody needs a watch because you have the microsecond on your smartphone. But it's kind of cool to wear a cool old or expensive watch, and it's a status symbol. And I think in 2050, is going to be so cool to drive a petrol car with a V8 engine and really look for a petrol station, which will be very rare by then, and drive around with a lot of noise and smoke coming out. And that's going to be like the old watches today.
We haven't seen horses on the road as the best way to get your groceries, right? To go to the grocery store. But there's still a lot of places where you can go to a stable and ride a horse. And we watch horses race, and it's probably going to be exactly the same with cars. Thank you so much, Elaine, for joining us. You've really opened up everyone's eyes, I think, as to how we're really going to own mobility in the future.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.